There are dozens of trees featured in Richard Powers' Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Overstory. Ancient oaks, acacias, Douglas firs, mulberries. One tree featured prominently in the book is in Utah. It's the aspen. When we talked with Powers a few weeks ago, you could tell he had a real affection for this tree, how unique they are as a living thing and how old they can be and the sound they make.
The aspen's an astonishing tree, and it's the great western tree for sure. And the next time you stand in front of an aspen, put your finger on the little stem that connects the leaf to the twig. It's called the petiole. And try to roll it between your fingers. You won't be able to because it's flattened. And when the wind blows, the leaf flips very violently in even a light breeze. One of the great joys of standing in front of an aspen is seeing it blink on and off because the top side of the leaf and the bottom side of the leaf are actually different colors. And to stand in front of it and see those, you know, that flickering light. And to hear it is like nothing else. I mean, the sound of an aspen is like the sound of running water in a stream. You know, it's a gorgeous, transcendent sound.
In the book, Powers tells of how one late fall afternoon, a plant biologist named Patricia Westerford pulls over to the side of the road along a stretch of the Fish Lake Scenic Byway. She walks up into a massive stand of aspens, works her way through fallen branches, and comes upon a small stream.
Tangled roots spill from the banks of a rivulet. She studies them, the exposed edge of a network of underground conduits conducting water and minerals across dozens of acres, up the rise to other, seemingly separate stems that line the rocky outcrops where water is hard to find. At the height of the rise is a little clearing, slashed down with a chainsaw. Someone has been out improving things. She produces her loop from her keychain and applies it to one stump to estimate the number of rings. The oldest downed trees are about 80 years. She smiles at the number, so comical, for these 50,000 baby trees all around her have sprouted from a rhizome mass too old to date even to the nearest 100 millennia. Underground, the 80-year-old trunks are 100,000 if they're a day. She wouldn't be surprised if this great, joined, single clonal creature that looks like a forest has been around for the better part of a million years. That's why she has stopped. To see one of the oldest, largest living things on Earth. All around her spreads one single male, whose genetically identical trunks cover more than 100 acres. The thing is outlandish, beyond her ability to wrap her head around. But then, as Dr. Westerford knows, the world's outlands everywhere. And trees like to toy with human thought like boys toy with beetles.
Patricia Westerford is just one of the 9 human characters in Powers' book, but she's the moral center of the novel. She's devoted her life to researching trees, and at this point in the book, she's on a long road trip trying to rebuild her career. She had written a paper, a breakthrough, saying trees aren't solitary, they're social. They have a biochemical behavior that allows them to communicate with each other. But the paper came years too soon, and she was mocked, dismissed, pretty much lost everything professionally. Powers writes that on her trip, Patricia had seen aspens in Canada, in New England, the upper Midwest, and that she had memorized the tone of that restless shudder. And then she hears it again. No other tree makes this sound.
Populus tremuloides. Clouds of gold leaf glint on thin trunks, tinted the palest green. The air is still, but the aspens shake as if in a wind. Aspens alone quake when all others stand in dead calm. Long, flattened leaf stalks twist at the slightest gust, and all around her, a million two-toned cadmium mirrors flicker against righteous blue. The oracle leaves turn the wind audible. They filter the dry light and fill it with expectation. Trunks run straight and bare, roughed with age at the bottom, then smooth and whitening up to the first branches. Circles of pale green lichen splatter paint them. She stands inside this white-gray room, a pillared foyer to the afterlife. The air shivers in gold, and the ground is littered with windfall and dead rammets. The ridge smells wide open and sere. The whole atmosphere is as good as a running mountain stream. Patricia Westerford hugs herself, and for no reason, begins to cry. The tree of the Navajo sunhouse chant. The tree Hercules turned into a wreath. The one he sacrificed when coming back from hell. The one whose brood leaves protected native hunters from evil. This, the most widely distributed tree in North America, with close kin on three continents, all at once feels unbearably rare.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Richard Powers is joining us to talk about his novel, The Overstory, which won the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. There's an opening moment in the book, a prologue, that plays out in a park above a western city. It's just after dark, and a woman is sitting on the ground leaning against a pine tree. And as Powers puts it in the book, the woman's ears tune down to the lowest frequencies, and she can hear the tree. And one of the things it tells her is that humans always imagine trees as amputations. It says, "Your kind never sees us whole." And that's where we began the conversation.
Well, the very first sense is literal. And it's an important literal sense that when we look at a tree, we're only looking at a portion of the mass. Maybe as little as half the mass of the tree. If you have ever seen a carefully excavated tree and seen the entire root system of these creatures, it's mind-blowing. We still aren't completely processing the complexity of the behavior of the tree because of only seeing a portion of the physical tree. So that first level literal sense shades over very quickly into this second order sense of you see a tree on a human time frame and you see only a very kind of macro view of a structure that can be incredibly complicated on the micro view. You see only the above ground. You're really filtering out the heart and soul and the complexity and the richness of these things. And then at the third order, you know, it's over the course of the book, the book absorbs the transformation in our thinking about individual trees and forests that has come about in recent decades through astonishing work into the what's it's not a stretch to call the intelligence of trees.
Yeah.
And we have lived alongside these creatures and have either never known or oftentimes culturally forgotten just how much they're doing. And in that sense, we never see them whole. We only see them as extensions of our own needs and our own aspirations.
One of the things I've heard you talk about is that there are these traditional forms of conflict in literature.
Mm.
And, you know, you learn it in literature class that there's person against person. There's person against him or herself. Mm. And then there's this third one, person against the environment.
Yeah.
And you've talked about how for some reason over time,
yeah,
that last conflict, that person versus the environment or that relationship, or that,
right,
that has disappeared.
Right.
Why do you figure that is? What do you make of that?
It's important to point out that that disappearance is relatively recent, and it starts in the West.
Yeah.
And that's a bit of a tip-off as to what's happening historically. Mm-hmm. Ceasing to take the non-human seriously, ceasing to think that we need to understand what the rest of life wants, is symptomatic of a transformation, a post-industrial transformation of the West, a growing separation of humans from the rest of the living world, a cultural notion that somehow we can have life on our own terms, we can control and master everything else that there is. Everything else that there is isn't really living in any kind of interesting way. It doesn't actually have agency or desire or volition, you know. And in fact, it's just here for our resources. It's just here to further this cause of self-creation of humanity. And I think that's when it disappears from our literature, from our stories. It's symptomatic of this illusion that we are self-made, mm-hmm, that we are separate, qualitatively different. And it's also, I think, a symptom of the collapse of meaning from something that exists out there, negotiated, mm-hmm, in the living world,
yeah,
and becomes instead a kind of private, synthetic, individual, commodity-mediated thing. We stopped telling those stories because we thought for a while that we defeated the non-human world,
yeah,
that the game was over, and
yeah,
we were the last species of significant standing, and we no longer had to consider what life wanted that might be different from what we want. And to understand now just how grave a mistake it was to think that we could go to war with nature and be victorious, you know, is going to change our sense of who we are, where we're going, what our future is, and what our stories have to look like.
Richard Powers, his novel The Overstory won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction this year. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hey, it's Lee Hale, host of the Preach Podcast. On our latest episode, public radio's favorite quiz show host.
I'm an agnostic, which is what an atheist says if you're afraid God will be mad.
I talk with Peter Sagal about how running became a meditative practice that helped him through a family crisis. Plus, he had a lot of questions about my Mormonism. Find Preach wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today, the writer Richard Powers is joining us, talking about his remarkable Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Overstory. Powers weaves together the story of nine people, but also hundreds of trees. He says he wanted to try and write a book where there was an actual link between a human and a tree. So I want to talk to you about as the time you're developing this idea for a novel.
Mm.
And I know at the time, or at least early on in this process, you're living in Palo Alto, you're teaching at Stanford.
Right.
And you find a kind of, I don't know, refuge by going west to the mountains that are there.
Yeah.
This became your antidote to the future, I think, is how you described it.
Yeah, I mean, you have to establish that, you know, that Stanford is right in the heart of Silicon Valley. In fact, Silicon Valley is there because Stanford is there.
It's right.
All the Stanford tech grads who are going out and doing these startups and changing the world through this digital revolution. And it's a go-go culture.
Yeah.
And it's a culture of techno-triumphalism. It really believes that all problems are going to be solved fairly soon by this this accelerating revolution that we're working. And that includes the biggest problem of them all, namely death. And that's a tough present to live in, and it's an oppressive future to sit there and wait for.
Yeah.
So yeah, and going up into the Santa Cruz Mountains just on the other side of town, and going up and seeing these redwood forests was a reconnection to a past that seemed more continuous and more integrated.
It's interesting you've talked about that at some point you had, I don't know, what seemed to me like this kind of moment of realization when you're in those trees, that, and this is how you put it, that we, what we weren't seeing, the magnitude of what had been lost, some sort of realization like that came to you when you were among those trees?
And that's interesting. It goes back to your original question. You humans only see the half of us. Yeah. And that was me. I mean, I got to that ripe old age of 55. I wouldn't even say I saw half. I was thinking, I was sort of aestheticizing trees. I mean, on occasion, an individual would be so remarkable that it would catch my attention. But I certainly wasn't seeing them as this enormous, diverse, ingenious, flexible, willful, distributed form of life, social, But it was up there in those mountains, if you've ever walked in a redwood forest, and you don't have to be a particularly sensitive soul to be astonished by a redwood. Well, it was by chance, on a day up there in these second growth redwood forests, that I came across an escapee, a tree that, for whatever historical reasons, managed to avoid the cutting that had taken the rest of the Santa Cruz Mountains. And to stumble upon a tree that's 20 feet wide and as tall as a football field is long and is, almost as old as Jesus, is to have a very large, knot yanked in your head. And it's just that, it was just a moment where I thought, I have not been paying attention. Several things immediately occurred to me. I mean, one is, this is what the whole mountain range looked like once, that the trees this size would have been all up and down. In fact, the range of the coastal redwood is from southern Oregon to Monterey, so these magnificent trees operating on a vastly different time scale and physical scale would have been the status quo in the form of life up in this area. And where did they go? And it was just a moment's reflection and realization that they went to build San Francisco. They went to build Leland Stanford's railroad. They went to build Stanford. They went to build Silicon Valley, directly and indirectly. And that realization that the future of human techno transcendence down there in the valley was down there because these majestic millennium long living trees were up here on the mountain. And I had never thought of the human story in that way. To realize that and to say, I've never seen that story told in literature. The story that says we are who we are by virtue of, taking advantage of who they are.
And you wanted to create that form, that you wanted to make a literature that did that, because you hadn't seen it before.
I wanted to tell a story that said there was no separate thing called the human adventure and no separate thing called untouched nature. The deeper I got into it, the more I realized, first of all, not only is it not irrelevant, it's at the heart of the hidden story of mankind, but it's not at all original. This is simply a recovery of the kind of stories that most humans would have told in most places of the world for most of human history. That is, we would never have dared to say, here's who we are and here's what we're doing. But everybody else, doesn't get to come on stage. You know, we hide all these other actors, all these other non-human actors, as if they weren't part of the story.
It's like there's a character I want to talk about, Patricia Westerford.
Mm.
Her father gives her a copy of Ovid's Metamorphoses.
Mm.
Is that the kind of literature you had in mind?
Absolutely. And it becomes a big intertext, but so do the myths and legends of cultures all over the globe. Because the more I looked into it, the more I realized if you can say there's any common denominator about the stories that people have told about being alive here on Earth, one of those common denominators would certainly be that trees are there.
Yeah.
So she's an interesting character, Patricia, and she becomes the kind of linchpin of the whole book.
Yeah.
She's the linchpin that pulls the human characters and the plant characters together. When she's born, she has a hearing impairment that her parents don't diagnose right away. And as is often the case, where hearing is somewhat limited, speech can also be impaired, and she doesn't speak well. She has trouble making herself understood to her classmates, and they other her. They kind of turn her into a monster, something that's not understandable to them. So she's alienated early on from humans. Fortunately, her dad, who's an agricultural extension agent, takes her under his wing and starts to teach her about this other world and these other creatures who actually are hugely powerful and are doing all these interesting things. And here she is, introduced to another community where hearing is not a problem. And speech is not a problem. And she begins to feel an affinity toward green things. And it puzzles her that other humans don't see how varied they are and how diverse they are, how astonishing and how beautiful their behavior is. And I think it's that predisposition. She's called Plant Patty as a kid.
Yeah.
And it's that feeling at home in the non-human world in the way that she doesn't feel in the human world, that predisposes her to a career in research, and that opens her to the possibility that consensual wisdom about the limits of plants might need to be reexamined.
But what's interesting, too, is that she makes animals out of twigs and leaves and acorns and things. And you describe her as, this is how you put it in the book, as the guiding spirit of this little kingdom that she's created.
Yeah, in a way, she's an animist.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And then her father, as you mentioned, an ag extension agent, he takes her with her on these road trips, and the connection that they have is special.
Mm.
And he mentions to her at one point what it means for most humans to be plant blind.
Yeah.
Calls it Adam's curse.
Yeah, and he says it's a shame, but we seem to have been shaped by natural selection only to be interested in things that are kind of our size, that kind of look like us, that kind of sound like us, that live on our time frame.
You also mentioned what he teaches her about that. This is how he puts it, the living sheath of cells underneath every square inch of bark, doing things no man has yet figured out.
Yeah.
When it occurred to me, what do we know really about trees?
And her story is very germane to that because she goes on to do some of the first research in the organic compounds that trees are putting out. Yeah. All the time. And different species of trees produce different combinations of biochemicals. We haven't even identified them all, let alone listed them all. Mm. So she does early research into this and discovers an astonishing thing, which is that when an individual tree is being compromised in some way, attacked by insects, in the case of her research, starts to produce insecticides, which in itself is kind of an astonishing thing. But, hey, I thought you said that trees are mechanical, you know, road and simple. Well, how is it that, you know, they can do these incredible biochemical responses? Well, that's just step one, because the tree that's under attack and producing these defenses is also releasing into the air chemical pheromones that act as signals to nearby trees.
It's warning the others. Is that too much to say?
I don't know. I mean, well, language is tricky.
It is tricky.
But you
get into that. I mean, you absolutely – it's like it's this message that her father teaches her, this idea that nothing is less isolated and more social than a tree.
That's right.
They're communicating. I don't know if that's the right word, but there's some community there.
I don't have trouble with that word.
Yeah.
But, you know, science is very, very careful. It's a set of disciplines based on many principles, the need to be able to repeat, the need to be able to measure and extract data that isn't ideologically dependent. And so there's been a long, long prohibition against anthropomorphizing. But when a scientist like Patricia sees that these chemicals go out into the air and that trees far away from the assaulted tree start to produce their own insecticides in advance of an incursion, you know, she says, look, there's a sender and there's a receiver and there's a behavior, a flexible behavior that's produced by virtue of the fact that what one tree produces has started, initiated behavior in another tree.
Yeah.
Call it what you want to call it.
Right.
It's not a stretch even to say there's a weird way in which, you know, these trees inside a society, inside a forest of organisms are sharing an immune system.
Yeah.
Right? So she puts that out and, you know, in a way that's analogous to the kind of nervousness that you and I, you know, are expressing with our language. You know, she triggers a nervousness in her field where they feel that she stepped over the line.
Yeah.
She's guilty of anthropomorphizing.
Right.
Right. So the group discipline circles the wagons, comes down, you know, meets out the punishment. And she basically is humiliated out of the field.
Yeah. She loses everything, at least in terms of the things that mattered. Her future, her research, her teaching work, all of that goes away.
Which, incidentally, my story draws on the story of researchers who do suffer severely from making observations that are troubling to consensual wisdom.
Let's say Jane Goodall. I know she was possibly one of the inspirations. Here she comes out. She goes in deep into the forest and she sees this behavior that she says, that's emotion. That's not just someone reacting to a stimulus. There's something else going on there. And she's mocked, like Patricia Westerford, your character, right?
That's absolutely right. In some ways, Jane Goodall had the strength and the self-possession needed to stay the course and resist that mockery. Patricia is much more sensitive and does retreat from the field. But look, that's a great example. And I hadn't actually thought of it in so specific a way. But when I was in school, my psychology professor was saying, you know, what you think is an emotional response in an animal is just a projection on your part.
Yeah.
And now that party line is mocked now in retrospect.
Right.
How did we ever go so long thinking that there wasn't an affective state in, you know, higher mammals that are so, you know, the problem is the prohibition against anthropomorphism produces indirectly anthrocentrism.
Yeah.
It produces the sense that somehow we are more separate than we really are.
It creates distance.
Yeah. And it's the same distance that we talked about earlier. It's the one that somehow merges too easily with this desire for economic dominance and mastery, to be outside of the vicissitudes of nature, to think that somehow our ability to use, you know, cognition might somehow solve the problems of having to live here on Earth.
There's a moment I wanted to ask you about that I was really touched by in the Patricia Westerford part of the book. It's at this moment, as we said, where she's lost everything. She's become dismissed and mocked by the scientific community. And it's at this moment when she contemplates ending her own life.
Yeah.
But it's at this moment when she almost does that she starts to realize the opinion of others doesn't matter or shouldn't matter. And in the novel, it says her real life starts here, this moment where she realizes it does. And I've heard you quote Proust, who says, the hermit is the person to whom the judgment of a society matters the most.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's somehow free of this idea that she has to be constrained by the opinion of somebody else.
You know, as you were talking, you know, it's a lovely connection that you're making there. But I was also thinking of Maslow and, you know, the tapes that he made at the end of his life and, you know, people listening to these for a hint as to this astonishing creativity and productivity and, you know, intellectual expansiveness. Where did it come from? Yeah. And he tells the story of, you know, thinking that he was going to die and then being spared that death and going into what he calls the post-mortem existence. And that's what Patricia does.
Yeah.
She says, since I didn't kill myself, I'm now in this astonishing bonus round, meaning no one can ever hurt me again as much as I almost hurt myself. Therefore, I am free to enjoy the complete integrity, the possibility of complete integrity in the world without worrying about what I'm supposed to think or see or feel.
I know that the idea of braiding different stories together, that's something that you've done before. You do that a lot in your work.
And so multiple
this is an order of magnitude, much more at least than you have in the past. How do you start creating a story that then becomes that? How are you thinking about that in the beginning?
And it's a long and winding road. And as I say, it unfolded over many years, which was a great gift. Hmm. I mean, in a sense that might be a little bit analogous to Patricia. I personally had to set aside the primacy of productivity and had to say, look, you know, maybe I'm in the bonus round. I've had these 11 other novels. You know, I've been writing for a third of a century. It's okay. If I get lost, it's okay. And so it was that freedom to go a little astray, I think, that gave me the luxury and the ability to step back and say, I'm going to pursue paths that are a little out there. And if they pan out, great. If they don't, it's actually the process has become more interesting to me than the product. But I knew that I was after this, you know, this kind of literature that harkened back to the myths and legends of people all over the globe, but at the same time was steeped in this amazing scientific revolution of the last 40 years or so, where we begin to see a surprising complexity in what we thought were almost kind of automaton-like things. Mm-hmm. You've heard this term regenerative agriculture, right? Yeah. Let's change the way that we farm and cultivate crops so that we're not killing the soil but actually enriching the soil, right? What I was looking for was a regenerative literature, right? Mm-hmm. And that I knew certain things. I mean, you know, for a while I thought, well, let me tell the story from the tree's point of view.
Yeah.
Let me have the central protagonists be trees. So I blundered into, you know, down that road for a while. But really what I discovered by going down that road is this is still wrong. To tell a story of trees as if the humans weren't part of the story is still wrong. Because, in fact, it's wrong in the same way that this devotion to a kind of literature that completely externalizes the non-human is wrong. Mm-hmm. I needed a book where the protagonists were both humans and non-humans. And somehow I needed to find a form where they could coexist in the same drama, even though they lived on different time frames and they had a different, completely different relationship to material reality.
You know, one thing I was noticing, there's a tree called Mimas in the book. And she, I always thought of her as a she, is that right?
Well, a coastal redwood actually would be both male and female.
Okay, so he and she,
right.
Mimas. I came to get a sense of a character on some other, like, sort of in between the lines of the story that's playing out as she plays this role in the lives of the characters. I did sense her being a character.
Yeah.
I guess a sentient sort of character in some really kind of deeply poetic way, for me anyway.
This may be an occasion for the pronoun,
yeah.
non-binary pronoun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. And that tree is not alone in having agency and in having narrative and dramatic interest. Mm-hmm. The book opens with an American chestnut that's brought out by a Norwegian immigrant to Iowa in the 19th century.
Jørgen Hoel,
that's right. And this tree that's taken so far out of its native range and becomes this kind of counterpoint to the family generational saga of immigrant descendant farmers in the Midwest. That tree also gets a kind of agency and a kind of dramatic role. And you know, there's this odd flipbook of still photographs that are made by generations of his descendants, and the sense that the drama of the tree and the drama of this family rising and falling in a kind of Buddenbrook's way over generations are happening in the same place, but they're happening in a way that's almost incommensurable, that you can't really see them as part of the same story until you step back and use this technological mediation to do it.
It's interesting too that Jørgen, he puts these chestnuts in a jacket pocket,
right.
Six of them,
right.
And then travels back to his treeless prairie home in Iowa, plants them, imagines his children eating chestnuts from these trees. But the point is that they are hundreds of miles away from where chestnuts would be and where they ultimately are decimated through this blight. Like they're the survivors because they're hundreds of miles away.
Yeah. It's a way of telling the American story obliquely.
Yeah.
You know, when I read about the chestnut blight, and you know, here's a species that was called America's perfect tree. And it ran from Maine down to Georgia. And there are estimates, you know, the number of individual chestnuts ran into the billions. It was one, they say in the East, in these regions, it was one out of every four trees was an American chestnut. And it was maybe not the very, very best of the categories by which we humans would measure the utility of trees, but it was among the best in almost everything. You know, spectacular building wood, incredible carvable. You know, you could make furniture out of it. It was gorgeous. It grew enormously. They're called the redwood of the East. If you Google American chestnut smokies, which is where I now live, you'll see these photos from the 19th century with, you know, 9 or 10 or 11 people standing in front of the bowl of a single chestnut. It would have a mast year every year. You know, in other words, a bountiful nut harvest every year. And again, in southern Appalachians, where I live, it was called the shoe tree because it was the only source of hard currency for these hardscrabble people who were living on these subsistence farms. They would be shin deep in chestnuts every fall.
Wow.
They could collect these things, bring them into cities, sell them, and buy shoes, right? So it was the backbone of economy throughout a large region. The blight comes into New York City through exotics, trees brought from Asia, and it's an infection, and the first sign of it is this mystifying outbreak in the very first couple years of the 20th century, 1904. By 1940, virtually every mature chestnut in the native range is dead. Mm-hmm. You know, they say that as the blight was spreading, you could stand on a ridge in Appalachia and just almost see the death spreading from one season, you know, to the next. Mm-hmm. And to think about that as an unsung moment in American history and transformation of a way of life overnight, you know, you have to open your eyes again to the part of, you know, our story that gets erased.
Yeah.
But as you say, you know, the book tells it from this perspective of, well, here's a tree that's so far out of the range that the blight doesn't get to it.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, another American story.
Nick Hull is a main character in the story,
right.
And he, on the farm, he starts sketching. He's an artist, and eventually he starts. There's this moment I love where he starts sketching branches.
Mm, yeah,
talk about this part of the story, because you mentioned how Nick is wondering, and this is how you put it in the book, what his brain would have to be like to distinguish each of the leaves on a branch and recognize them. So talk a little bit about this idea of, here's an artist now looking, trying to recognize the distinctions in trees. Well, they all look like just one same thing.
Yeah.
He's trying to see something deeper here.
So, you know, it's so interesting. This is just a tiny aside and then I'll come back. But people who suffer from prosopoagnosia, who can't actually distinguish between different human faces, will sometimes use that. They'll say, imagine looking up at a tree and trying to tell the difference between two leaves.
Right.
That's what we have to deal with when we deal with human faces. He's sort of trying to do the inverse of that.
Right. Right.
He's saying, well, imagine I'm a squirrel, in which case I've been naturally selected to be very, very sensitive to the differences between each individual leaf shape or something like that. But it's a discipline of attention and presence.
Yep.
How strong can you make your ability to stand rawly in front of the living world and to not dismiss it because it of Adam's curse, you know, to go back to Patricia's father, to not dismiss it because it doesn't look like us and it doesn't, you know, operate on our time frame or doesn't seem to have direct significance to us. The reason he is like me is he's a Midwesterner. He's an introvert. He has the ability to get lost in his own interior thought processes.
Yeah.
He's a bit obsessed with this idea of looking past expected or received wisdom. And he's a little out there. So all of those things, I think, made it a pleasure for me to create this character. He's also taken way out of his comfort zone in the rest of the story.
Yes.
You know, and thrown into this dramatic confrontation where this handful of people who aren't particularly political, who aren't particularly inclined to take trees seriously, are, for various different reasons, made horribly aware that we are watching the last, you know, the disappearance of the last 2 or 3% of old growth forest in the United States, and that maybe we might want to stop before this unknown, unexplored, untapped natural patrimony, you know, deep, deep treasury, is destroyed forever. So he gets sucked up into that, and before you know it, this taciturn, introverted Midwestern, you know, strange artist is a tree sitter.
Yeah, yeah.
And a frontline activist.
Well, they all become, they're not at all political at first, but they all become transformed into activists, into political creatures in the way they weren't before.
That's right. And, you know, in a way, it's a kind of extreme form of this transformation that I experienced up in Santa Cruz Mountains. The rest of that Santa Cruz Mountain story is germane to this. When I had my moment and saw this, you know, this old redwood and realized that my own conception about what life is capable of doing was deficient, my own conception of human history was deficient, to come down out of those mountains and to see stands of coastal redwoods with paint marks on them, and to determine, to my astonishment, that those marks meant cut these. And to educate myself and to realize that they were slated to be cut as recently as a decade and a half before I was seeing them, and that they represented, you know, that final 2 or 3% of old growth redwood forest that would have disappeared forever had not people taken this direct action. And it was that discovery, my own political naivete, my own obliviousness to something that was so recent, that should have been frontline news, you know, that I should have been paying attention to, that formed the genesis of the heart of the drama of the book.
There's this moment in the novel when Patricia is in the Western Cascades. And I think, as you put it in the book, nothing had really prepared her for that experience, yeah, despite having been deeply connected to green things all her life. But she was so taken by this experience. And there's this lovely moment where she addresses these massive trees.
Yeah. And she uses the formula of the indigenous people from the region, the many, many groups of Aboriginal inhabitants of the Pacific Northwest, and there is an often repeated and you know, long duration tradition of directly addressing and thanking the tree for everything that the tree has given. As she does so, I mean, she's self-conscious at first. You know, she's a scientist, and she's, you know, she's one of us, and she's a contemporary modern human, and she knows the history of this form, and she's a little self-conscious, but she starts going and she starts thanking the tree, and there's no end to it. Yeah. You know, there are so many things to thank it for, and it just overwhelms her, and she ends that prayer that of thanksgiving saying, "We're sorry, we didn't know how long it takes you to come back." But this idea of talking to the non-human, it's interesting, and it's the cliche of the tree hugger, you know, like talk to plants, I talk to, and it's an object of mockery for those of us who have committed to this other form of being, this, you know, this pragmatic, material, economical, you know, sensible, separatist sort of sensibility. Are you expecting them to talk back to you? Do you think they're going to actually listen? Are they going to change their behavior because you're talking to them? You know, the writer David Abram singled out that passage and said he loves that moment. He said, the reason is this: when I talk to trees, it's not about whether they're hearing or understanding me or going to reply. It's about what changes in me. He says, the moment I address a tree out loud, that tree goes from being an object to being a subject. I've put them on an equal footing with me. I've given them a kind of sanctity that we human beings only ever give ourselves.
Let me ask you this finally. You've talked about how you want to keep writing the same book again and again.
Yeah.
You want to come back to this form,
yeah,
again. You don't want to just treat it as this project that, and then move on from.
Yeah.
How are you thinking about that now?
You know, I'm in the bonus round. I'm in my own little postmortem existence now. And I think it, you know, there's so much going on in the forest. And I truly believe that, you know, if we're to survive this unthinkable, catastrophic future that we've unleashed on ourselves, we're only going to do it by reconnecting and re-inhabiting, you know, and rehabilitating. And I think literature can be part of that process, and I want to be working on that kind of literature.
Richard Powers, his book is The Overstory. It won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Radio West is a production of KUER. Our thanks to our intern, Natu Twe. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard, by Ale Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.